Such a pleasure to finally meet you.
Finally, indeed. My word. It's a palace.
Thank you. It's home.
You look nothing like what I expected.
Here, let me get your coat.
Oh, how refreshing. One longs for courtesy, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely.
And there is so little of it.
What can I get you to drink?
Don't you wonder what I thought you'd look like?
I'm afraid to ask.
All right, welcome back to Chandralon Wedding Talk. I'm your host, Scott, and I'm here with...
Jason.
And Doug.
And we're going to talk about Chandralon weddings for a solid hour, because they're my favorite thing ever.
Don't forget awkward dinner parties between, like, an in-law and, you know... Imperial
well, we can
soldier.
Get to that.
We'll yeah. get to that. But as we're discussing the wedding, mm-hmm. the one thought that I want both of you to keep in the back of your head is, when did they rehearse this? How long did they have to rehearse this? Because they go through some pretty choreographed, complicated ceremony stuff.
Yeah.
You're just jumping down just, the deep end.
We're just crapping on weddings all.
This wedding.
All right. Let's. That's going to be probably the biggest section. So let's get started. We're talking about Andor Season 2, Episode 3, which I did not write the name down of this episode. Does anybody know?
Harvest.
Yeah, Harvest.
Okay. Episode opens. We see Cassian, like, stuck in the... Did we ever figure out what the name of that ship was? The Imperial TIE Destroyer?
The TIE Avenger? TIE Avenger.
TIE Avenger.
And he's, like, stripping wires so he can, like, basically hotwire it? Is that the impression?
Well, I think he was trying to start up communication with, you know, Kleya.
Hold
it
on.
Wasn't communication because, like, he couldn't get it go. Like, he sparked it and then it moved.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, kind of seemed
so
weird.
I was trying to figure out, like, so did he stall it out and he couldn't start it again? Like, he didn't have the keys, so he had to hotwire? I don't know.
It was cool. I didn't think about it.
It was like a 20-second scene of him.
Yeah. I mean, when he initially stole it, it died on him and he had to, like, kind of kickstart it to get it moving again. So it's not unreasonable to think that, oh, maybe it just conked out on him when he was traveling through space.
And he does talk about it later that the ship is having problems. It's just funny that he's literally got two exposed pieces of wire that he's short.
I do want to clarify something, though, because you raised the question and then you didn't answer it. We decided to call it a proto-TIE fighter.
Proto-TIE. There we go. You have a better memory than I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. There's a quick scene with Kleya. We see her back at her there. Because does Luthen own that shop and she works for him is the impression I get?
Yeah.
She's at the shop. She finally picks up Cassian on the radio. They've been, you know, Cassian's been incommunicado for months. He asked for a weather report, which I assume was like some kind of code for, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly they're in space. And anyway, so he asked for a weather report. And Cassian does mention that he's mad. He's frustrated that the ship that he's on is not the ship that he was trained to fly, which is why he's having problems flying it, probably why he has to jump start or short circuit it. And also, like, the first episode where he crashes it out of the hangar. So I guess the implication here is that he thought he would be in a different ship than what he actually ended up in.
It's kind of interesting. He was trained on one that he thought this goes forward, but it actually goes backwards.
Right.
It's, like, completely opposite because he starts out and it just goes in reverse, like, crashes
and literally crashes into the wall. Right.
Quite a different control scheme. You'd think they would be somewhat similar, but no.
He mentions that he wants to call home, so we assume that he's calling home to talk to Bix. And Kleya tells him, no, do not do that. What does she say? There's a lot of people there, or it's very popular, something like that. And she mentions that there's a frequency blockade, which they say in the last episode, they do a frequency blockade whenever they do an audit or whatever the Imperials are doing on that planet. They shut down all communication so nobody can send a message off planet about what's going on. Which is weird because later Cassian is able to get a message into Bix. I mean, we'll talk about that when we get to it. And then we've got a whole bunch of stuff going on. The two main parts of this, well, I guess there's three. We've got, we'll start with the farm stuff or the harvest stuff, I guess. We see, like, an Amish-style outdoor dinner party. I mean, they've got, like, what, 30, 40 feet of tables and there's whatever, 45 people having dinner. They mentioned that whatever section they're in is going to be next on the Imperial inspection schedule, and that the Imperials have already found some hiding illegals, I guess is the implication, in the 600 block. So the Imperials are going, I assume, farm by farm, checking to see who's legal and who's not. And Brasso and Bix and Will are clearly illegal, and they're very nervous. So the owner of whatever the farm that they're on, his name is Kellen, he gives them an emergency work order for the 800 block, and it basically gets them out of the area while they do the inspection. But the paperwork is a little sketchy, so he tells them not to use it unless you absolutely have to. So the implication is that they're going to be inspected in the next couple days, and they're getting the heck out of Dodge so that they don't get caught and thrown in Imperial jail.
And this Kellen guy seems really nervous.
Right.
Which is interesting. I want to talk about what ultimately happens near the end with him, but...
We see, and I was watching this, and we see that B2SO is really sad because they're leaving and he doesn't get to go with them. He's really worried that, who's going to tell Cassian, or who's going to listen for Cassian, or things like that. He's worried. Anyway, full-on robot emotions.
I will just say, every scene that B2SO has been given in season two just really serves to remind me how much I'm happy that I haven't had to watch B2SO in season two very much.
Well, yeah, is he going to get left behind here? We're not going to see him anymore?
Well, he adds nothing.
That would be a tragedy, I'll say that,
Brasso,
no sarcasm.
Leaves him with that redheaded farm friend that he has, and she's talking to B2SO like he's a kid, we're going to have so much fun when he's gone. You'll forget they even exist. Like the same kind of thing you would tell a four-year-old. It just made me laugh. We see, as the Imperials roll in, they make Will nervous. Will hops on his speeder and, he's making out with his girlfriend, and she puts her arms around his waist, and he's got a gun in his hip, in his pocket or whatever. And she's all nervous because they're illegals and the Imperials are coming. You shouldn't have a weapon. You're just asking for problems. And then, so the Imperials show up to the little farm store, whatever, the farmer's market kind of thing. And the leader gets off and he was like, all right, we're going to be doing some work around here. I need you to feed 30 of my men. Just like that, I guess that's what they do. They just show up and they're like, okay, we're going to live here for a while and you got to feed all my people. And mm-hmm. It was clearly
It's the SS coming in.
Town. Right. That's where I was going. It's very heavy handed. They're like, we're here to make sure you don't have any illegals. And while we're here, make sure that all my men are treated well.
See, I was getting Revolutionary War vibes from that. British soldiers coming into town and you're forced to feed and quarter them. And
I think it's, largely the same thing. Bix is trying to raise Cassian on the radio. Because they're going to get the heck out of Dodge, and she doesn't want Cassian to show up, and she's not there or they're not there. So, but she does not, she's not able to raise, is she able to right there? I can't remember where it is. She eventually is able to get Cassian on the radio, which is interesting because, again, they said they had that Imperial blockade on all communications. And then, in the middle of the conversation, it cuts off.
Mm.
So we got armed Imperials have rolled up. We got essentially tanks, I guess. And stormtroopers with guns. So, it's looking, very SS-like as they walk through this very small farm community. Brasso gets caught by a stormtrooper. And so he's sort of, I guess, being held while they interrogate him. And we see this super creepy Imperial hitting on Bix, the same guy from the last episode. He was like, oh, is your husband back yet? Wink, wink, what are you doing kind of thing. And he even tells her, he's like, I know you're illegal. It's fine, though, Don't worry about it. I've got a really stressful job. I'm always looking for ways to relax. My shoulders are really tight. And he looks at Bix and he's like, oh, you look like you have really strong hands working on the farm. In a super creepy way. He did a really good job of being super creepy. And then Bix just basically is having none of it and essentially hits him in the face with a wrench once. And then he kind of reels back and comes at her again, and she hits him again. I'm like, I'm surprised it didn't kill him. I mean, it was a big metal wrench in the head.
Well, I think he's down for the count for the rest of the episode, so I think he's out.
Well, she hits him once, and he goes back kind of against the wall and then comes back at her again, and she hits him again, and then he staggers outside and collapses.
Oh, he's still up at that point? Okay.
Yeah, but then the other guy who was outside saw what was happening.
He hears the radio, because the guy screams inside, and then he radios all the other Imperials, like, hey, something's going on, you got to come over here. But Bix...
pretty disturbing scene, you know? I mean...
Yeah, it was pretty violent. Like, he was clearly... he was going to rape her. He was not having... I mean, Bix even says, you know, hey, he was going to rape me. And, and then another Imperial shows up and sees the dead guard lying on the ground. Will shows up basically to save the day, because it's the Imperials versus Bix at that point. And you see Will pull out his gun, and you think he's going to have to save the day and kill this guy so they can escape. And then Bix just steps out into the door and just executes the second guy with a shotgun, like, you know, Han shoots first style. So what do you guys think about that? I thought that was a really well-done scene, because the whole him being creepy and throwing himself at her, I thought it was well done. I think it paints a portrait of things that illegals would have to put up with, because you can't go to the authorities. You can't report that, because you don't have any legal standing not being a legal citizen. So this is the kind of stuff that just happens.
I just think it's a really well done scene. But also, this is where I was like, kind of wanted to mix some of the scenes, because you see a bit of a juxtapositions and flashes backs to Mon Mothma in the wedding ceremony, her kind of realizing that, you know, she may have to kill Tay. We'll get into that. But like, there's a flashback between those two events, Bix kind of getting creeped on and then Mon Mothma dancing, you know, in a sort of distress. I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition. It's just really well done. You know, nice to see two, you know, women in this rebellious situation, but very different situations, obviously, but still.
But both very uncomfortable.
Oppressed and, just dealing with this fascist, you know, regime, this fascist situation in different ways. Yeah, I thought it was really well done, but disturbing.
Doug? Doug's nodding.
I think it was pointed out at the time that the episode dropped, at least I definitely saw it online, the attempted rape scene with Bix is the first depiction of rape in the Star Wars universe.
Oh, interesting.
Which, I mean, thinking back, like, obviously with Jabba, there was definitely some...
undertones?
Yeah. I mean... I think Slave Leia.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Dressed all skimpy.
Oh yeah.
But you're right. It's all off screen, right? You show up in Jabba's palace and she's in a bikini and that's it, right? There's no.
Yeah, it's not outright stated. This was very much in your face, like raw, uncomfortable.
Like at one point, he's literally dragging her by the foot. I think she's upside down. Even like he's kind of dragging her to the bedroom or whatever.
Uh huh.
Yeah, it was very right. I never figured out the whole Slave Leia and Jabba thing. I mean, he's like a worm, so like, what's he?
Yeah.
What are the physics of that?
Yeah, how does that work? Is it just like he just likes watching her dance? Like, it was kind of like,
Yeah, he just had a harem of different women.
That's true. I mean, he had like, a whole bunch of them. It wasn't just Leia. It was
collections. He liked collections, I think. You know, he collected things. He collected Han. Anyway, we're getting off track.
That was all I had on the farm stuff. That was...
But first sexual assault in Star Wars universe, pretty significant. I mean, many firsts in the show. I think the first depiction of serial.
If any show was going to do it, it would have been Andor, just because it addresses these darker themes, right? I mean, like, largely the movies, they're kids' movies, right? You don't address dark themes like this in a kids' movie or even a PG-13 movie.
I mean, for the most part, a lot of the Star Wars universe is very... black and white, good guys, bad guys, and...
literally black and white, yeah.
Andor is, one, not afraid to show some subtlety. Like, Andor himself, he's the hero. Who shoots first? who has straight up murdered people.
We see it in this scene. Actually, yeah, so that's...
Or even just Luthen as a character.
Luthen.
Luthen exactly. is the best example he of is not being...
The most villainous hero, I think, that's ever been on screen in the Star Wars universe.
I think it's the major project of this show is to show, first, the real brutality of a fascist organization, a fascist society, and also the messy, just horrible way that a resistance has to come about. It's ugly. Like, it's usually not a pretty thing. I mean, we see this in reality, you know, in real situations in Israel, in Gaza. I mean, there's, you know...
There's no black and white in reality, right?
And it's
very rare you get a Hitler who is so obviously the bad guy that...
It's hard not to draw those connections, no, but it's also a universal story.
I do want to clarify just for posterity here. I am not saying there's any gray area in the rape scene.
Right.
Okay. I don't think
that was atrocious and bad and not justifiable in any way, shape, or form. The point is the show is not afraid to get gritty.
Yes.
It's not going to shy away from the hard stuff. So I appreciate that.
It makes
it that much better.
Star Wars has set the stage for this pretty dark situation of an empire controlling every society across the galaxy. What does that really look like? I mean, what, you know, we're just sort of uncovering the reality of that.
That's a good point. We never see that in the movies. It's just the empire is there and they're very oppressive and they're very clearly the bad guys. But you very rarely see them doing bad things.
Well, they destroy the entire planet.
I mean, okay, there's that. There was just one time, though.
Little planet.
I do.
A lot of the really bad stuff they do happens off screen, I guess is what I'm saying, is they're not hitting you in the face with it. Here's Vader murdering a guy. Does Vader kill anybody in the original? I mean, maybe one of the starfighters or whatever, but it's not... I guess he does in Rogue One at the end when he,
he like takes out that
whole corridor. He executes like 10, But in the original trilogy, I mean, like, that's what I'm saying. You have this just literally the space Hitler. He's literally black head to toe. I mean, he's the most bad guy you could have. And you don't see him being horrendously a terrible person. A lot of that happens off screen, again, because I feel like it's a kid's movie. But here... We got like middle managers, this guy that's assaulting Bix, and they're not afraid to show that. So the one thing I want to ask you guys about the farm scene, and I didn't fully understand this, is Cassian shows up in his ship at the very end and basically executes a bunch of stormtroopers running through the fields, like from space or from the atmosphere, I guess. He shoots and bombs a bunch of these guys. And does he hit Brasso? Because at one point he gets out of his ship and he walks over to Brasso's speeder and Brasso's unconscious. So I think the implication is that he's dead and that perhaps he killed Brasso as at like collateral damage.
I do not recall it going down that way at all.
All I know is that he lands and he sees Brasso unconscious. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure if the stormtroopers had done that and left him there or he had hit him.
No, I don't think so. I mean... The way I recall is he finally kind of arrives and he takes out the transport that they've called to go to Bix because that guy called it in. He takes out that transport, but Brasso's trying to make a getaway on the speeder.
He's on that speeder, right?
But it's sort of an open field. He's an easy target, and the stormtroopers just take him down as they,
whatever happens off screen. So it wasn't
clear.
They
actually hit their target for once.
Maybe. And Cassian shoots that silo and basically crushes whatever those stormtroopers with the wheat or whatever was in there. That was interesting.
It was cool.
All right, let's move on to the Daedra scene. So while all this stuff is going on at the farm, Daedra and Cyril are having a hot dinner date with Cyril's mom. And they have the most sterile apartment I've ever... The implication is they're living together, right? I mean, I don't think you have... The reason I ask is because there is no decoration. There is no flowers. There is no nothing in this apartment to indicate that anyone lives there, other than the fact that a bedroom exists. There is the most sterile apartment I've ever seen. And also, There's no color in their entire apartment. Nothing. Like, it almost looked black and white. Other than Cyril and Deirdre's face, which is flesh-colored, everything else is black and white. Like, the set designers and costume designers, like, worked really hard to make it... I mean, it looks like an operating room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've got good taste.
Like, at one point, like... Deirdre's holding up two different black blouses. She's trying to decide which one she wants to wear. Like, they look identical, essentially, because they're just black.
And she's, like, practicing smiling in the mirror. That was, like, one of my favorite parts.
And it was super creepy, too. Like, it just looks out of place for her character. Like, she smiles, and you're like, oh, God, it looks like she's about to murder puppies or something, right?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, yeah. I have a quote from that when they actually, you know, have dinner, and it's just... It's the best. This was my highlight of the episode.
This scene was great, just because the tension is so thick,
it's so awkward.
So
but
they're
like,
basically,
you believe it. Like, these are characters that have been built up, but they're just so out there characters. But they've been established, and so it's awkward and tense and weird and awesome. You know, it's just sort of gross and awesome at the same time.
Well, I mean, they're clearly preparing for this dinner. Like, this has been in preparation for a week or two. I mean, so there.
Was this not what he was referring to in the previous episode?
Yeah, now that I'm seeing this, it sure seems like...
Can't we just pretend that we're not back or whatever he was saying?
His mom must have put some pressure. Hey, I want to come over and meet your new girlfriend kind of thing. Did you guys notice that... Okay, so again, the apartment's all black and white. It's all shades of gray. And then what's his mom's name? Did anybody write it down? I didn't.
Edie?
Yeah, that sounds
Edie,
right.
So the door knocks or doorbell rings, whatever. They go over to the door, and she's wearing the brightest orange outfit. Mm-hmm. You can see it's bright orange and red. It's a complete contrast to what the apartment and the clothes that they're wearing. Like, she just stands out, like, clearly just to indicate that visually that she's out of place here.
Yeah, I mean, I will just jump. So, like... We find out that Cyril's father left him, and so he's been stuck with his mom, his mother's love, raising him. And so, like, he hates her. He obviously hates her and really is embarrassed, and so has kind of been attracted to someone who's the opposite, obviously. And
hang on. You think Cyril's mom and Deirdre are opposites?
I think that's kind of, you know.
Oh, really? I think they're very, very similar, right? They're both just oppressive female characters. Yeah, I think, like...
So he likes that aspect of the being controlled, or he's used to that. Like, he's kind of...
He's looking for a dommy mommy.
He wants a dommy.
I mean, isn't that a saying? Like, most guys marry their mothers. Like, I mean, that's your depiction of femininity your whole life.
There's elements there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cyril's mom mentions, she's explaining Cyril's past, that his dad left them both when they were very young, and that he was raised by his mom. And she name drops Uncle Harlow, and she's like, well, if it wasn't for Uncle Harlow, we would have been in a really hard spot. Like, he really bailed us out. So I assume the implication there is that he's supporting them financially and also potentially politically. But she makes a point to mention the name Harlow, because I assume that's a well-known name in this universe. And Deirdre shoots back basically, oh, well, that's nice. At least he had a mom. I had no parents. My parents were criminals, and I was raised in, what did she say, in imperial kinder care? Or essentially, her parents were prisoners, and so she had to be raised by the Empire?
Yeah. It sounds like it was like kiddie jail, basically, because her parents were arrested. And so it was a kinder block, which, you know, sounds like a
German sound like Nazi thing.
You can imagine, imagine the prisons in this universe that we've seen in season one. Imagine what like a kinder block is. If it's even like 20% as bad as that was, that it's probably, you know, just horrific.
Do you think those kids had electric floors too?
Probably.
That would be,
I mean, something to keep kids in
line. I wouldn't
put
it past this empire in this series. I mean, and that's what's so great is like he's established all these elements that the empire is capable of. And so she mentions imperial kinder block, and it immediately, like, just my imagination runs wild with what that looks like, you know? So yeah, that's just awesome.
Well, Cyril is clearly extremely uncomfortable at this dinner that they're having. Like, he's watching his mom. It's basically like his mom meeting his new girlfriend, and he just does not know how to process it. Like, he's physically uncomfortable. At one point, he gets up and just goes in the other room and just lays on the bed because he's overwhelmed.
Dude, I've totally done that with my in-laws.
Yeah. Like, I've done that with my wife.
Can't help feel for him.
So Cyril gets up and walks away, and Edie looks at Daedra and says, "Oh, don't worry, you'll toughen him up." Mm-hmm. And Daedra, like, just tells her off. She basically says, you know, "Hey, knock that crap off. I'm going to control his life from here on out. If you want to have any sort of relationship at all with your son, you need to make his life, make our lives drama free."
And but, she basically, here's the quote.
Yeah, what's the quote?
"I will guarantee a level of engagement, but it will be inversely proportional to the volume of anxiety you generate in our lives."
"You'll toughen him up."
"I have a different plan in mind. But when I say the word plan, that makes it sound optional, which is not the impression you should be taking away. This game ends now. You want Cyril in your life, you will think before you speak. I'll make sure he visits twice a month. I'll make sure that he calls you. I will guarantee a level of engagement, but it will be inversely proportional to the volume of anxiety you generate in our lives."
Quite a mouthful.
"I'm not done."
That's like the most like accounting answer you could give to someone. Inversely proportional to the amount, like, what? I kind of expected like Edie to put up a fight, but she was just kind of like cowed. You're like, you know, I expected him to get into it, but right about then, like, Cyril walks back into the room and they're kind of getting along because I think they've come to an agreement, like, okay, neither one of us is going to back down.
Well, I think if I'm my interpretation, his mom recognized that Daedra was a strong, dominant, controlling woman, and she feels like that's what her son needs. That's the role that she's fulfilled. So now that she kind of got bitch slapped by Daedra, she sees, like, oh, okay, this is the type of woman that will be best for my son. So I embrace this. I accept her in this role.
I mean, isn't that what, I mean, I've got teenagers, right? I mean, isn't that what a parent wants? Is you want your kids to find someone who's going to take care of them, or at least they're compatible with? This is the first time they're ever meeting, right? I mean, for all she knows, Daedra could have been a prostitute. She could have been, you know, lazy. She could have been whatever. So when she shows up and sees that Daedra's actually engaged and, you know, is going to be involved in, she's probably a little bit relieved. Like, okay, cool. I don't have to worry about, you know, taking care of this guy the rest of my life.
I think you guys are giving her way too much credit. I think she's a narcissist, and I think she's,
like, probably, are we talking about?
Both of them.
Maybe both, but, like, the mom, Edie, I think she's a controlling narcissist, and I think she probably despises Daedra for, you know, for taking over what she feels is his or hers.
On some level, yeah, for sure. But also on another level, I think, like, game recognize game.
Maybe. I think there's definitely an aspect to that. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. I can see that.
But props to all the actors in that scene. Most uncomfortable dinner party I think I've ever seen.
Since The Office.
Okay. All right. Props to the set team and the costume designers. I mean, that was the most black and white scene I've ever seen on TV. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed not enjoying it.
I mean, go back and look at the apartment. I'm not kidding. Like, I'm just looking around this room. Like, we've got flowers and, like, art hanging on a wall. None of that. There's literally nothing. It looks like an operating room. Like, it's just crazy how simplistic it was.
Yeah, the actress that plays Daedra might be my favorite character in the whole series, and I think she deserves, like, awards. Actually, I think it was the Emmys just came out, and nobody from Andor was nominated, which was...
Did you see? I was going to send it to you guys yesterday. Tony Gilroy had a quote on that because they asked him about that. Like, whoa, how do you feel about none of your actors getting nominated? And I'm going to butcher the line, but he basically said something about, this is not about the short game. This is about the long game. He was like, I don't care what people think right now. I care what people are going to be talking about in 10 years, because that's going to be what sticks with you, not this, you know, one performance that they gave. It was actually a really good response, because I think that's true.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's such a great way to look at it as far as any creative endeavor. Like, don't worry about the accolades, but still. Freaking Daedra should have gotten nominated.
For sure.
Like, bullcrap. Anyway.
Anything else you guys want to cover on the Daedra thing, and then we'll move into the wedding, because I can. I'm just looking at Doug, and he is really excited to talk about this wedding.
Well, there was one bit like where Daedra says about Uncle Harlow that she looked into his criminal records, and it's not a story you want to advertise. So there may be more of that coming. I don't know, but it seems like that's an interesting issue.
Well, like Edie's basically saying, hey, I'm just letting you know we've got this guy, Uncle Harlow, in our life, and he's got some political clout. So if need be, I can make some calls and make your life miserable, kind of thing. And Daedra's like, I looked into him, and he's way more trouble than he's worth. Don't threaten me with that, is essentially what she says.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to the wedding.
Yay.
Third day of the wedding. Is it multiple days?
I guess
Day. Yeah.
Huh. More than
3 days, wasn't it?
The scene opens. The wedding opens with Mon Mothma and Veda in kind of like this Japanese style looking room with a bamboo floor and circle doors. It was very artistic. Veda's clearly nervous because she's just about to go out and get married. And Mon Mothma says something really interesting. She basically offers Veda a way out. Because I think maybe Mon Mothma realizes, that she realized she got in bed with the devil kind of thing to make this thing happen. And I wrote down the quote. She gives them both an opportunity, like, let's just walk away. The quote is, she said, "It's not time yet for a marriage. We can put it off, and it will be remembered as an act of great bravery." So she's basically saying, we'll go out to this wedding, you and me together. We'll say, cool, thanks everybody for coming. It's not a good time for a wedding. And then just walk away instead of being forced politically into this matrimony.
Well, when she's sugarcoating the disaster it would be for her and her political situation. Like, if she didn't go through with it. But the fact that she's giving her daughter an out here is more of a desperate way to like kind of protect her daughter or give her a chance. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly what her motivations here are, but
didn't she talk about her past and how she was in that situation and like she didn't.
She said what she said was, when I was here in this exact same room when I was getting married, your grandmother, my mom, was completely drunk. And I think the implication is that that's how she got through this ceremony, is the same sort of thing. Like, it's a bad political, it's a political marriage more than it is anything else. And that her mom basically had to drink herself to get through it. Anyway, the point is that Veda says, no, I want to go through with this wedding.
Yeah.
Was it Leda? Okay. Leda says, I want to go through with this wedding. And then she looks at Mon Mothma and she goes, I wish you were drunk. So they go out to continue the wedding. We see a really cool tree stick dance, very ceremonial. Yes.
How long did they rehearse that?
I got some like classic Jewish wedding vibes from that, or maybe some African vibes. Clearly, it's very traditional Chandralan.
Yeah.
Stecken gets a knife from Perrin, right? They have this speech about, once I give you this knife, it can't ever come back. And he goes over and cuts off her hair. All very ceremonious. Mm-hmm. I assume super typical Chandralan. Doug, what are your opinions on that?
Again, how long did they rehearse all this? When did they talk about these lines? How long did they like prepare and where's the book that says this is the ceremony and the order of
events? Why do you care about what they prepared for?
I care because it's unrealistic.
What? You didn't? I mean, I did stuff like that at my wedding. Like, you had a whole day ahead of time. You're prepping. You're talking about
where
you're
going to
stand and who's going to hold the rings. And
we're talking at a minimum 3 days packed full of all of this crap, all of this ceremony, all of this stuff, nonstop. 3 days. When the hell did they learn how to do this?
You don't think there was like a break and they're like, okay, guys, for the next, get the wedding party in here. We got to practice this tree dance.
Show us that then.
You want to see the prep?
No, I don't. I don't want to see any of it.
Yeah.
I don't even want to see the final result, yet I was forced to. Andor raped me.
Oh, jeez. I was vibing on this wedding. I would 100% love to go to a Chandralan wedding. I know I said it before, but I keep looking at it. This is a Kardashian wedding. This is just rich people being rich, showing off. They've got some old customs that, you know, hey, you know what? Grandma wore this dress when I was getting married, so now you're wearing it. Grandma jumped over a tree branch. Like, that's how we do things. That's how our family works.
Then they got drunk and listened to Star Wars techno. It was really awkward.
Okay. All right.
But so the culture is like, isn't it thousands of years old? Like this tradition, history, like it seems like it's probably just ingrained in their everyday life. They probably practiced this since they were kids. Who knows? You know, like,
you know what? I suppose that's a good point. I mean, probably they've all been to other weddings.
Yeah.
So you've probably seen this stick dance and this knife dance. I mean, you've probably seen it 100 times. You probably don't even need to practice. You were born into it.
I don't think their culture, like their whole year is just spent every weekend going to 3-day weddings. That sounds terrible.
Dude, it takes up a lot of time.
This wedding looked dope. I would totally go to this wedding. All right,
that's where you're wrong. We'll get to that wedding. It looked stuffy and oppressive.
It was just a big party.
Terrible.
Until the techno bot came out, and then it got sick.
3 days long. 3 days.
It's too much wedding.
A ceremony? Like, yeah. I mean, it just shows kind of the stiffness of their society and how everything has been like handed down, and they're just kind of playing roles. And it's just a great just setup as far as like building those characters and the world. I
was more comfortable watching the dinner party than I was watching the wedding.
Oh my,
just awkward.
I could somewhat agree with you. I mean, the wedding is not meant to be like a happy go lucky thing. It's a oppressive, stiff.
Yep.
Tradition that, you know, is a good setting for someone like Mon Mothma, who's trying to rebel against it and trying to, you know, maintain her posure and grace in the face of all these things that seem to be kind of crashing down around her. So
I will point this out, backing up a half a step. She has that little moment of outreach to her daughter, like, hey, it's totally cool. If you don't want to do this, I'll stick by you. It won't even be a big thing. Read the room. Your daughter has wanted this from the very first moment.
You think she...
Yeah.
Oh, I...
Her daughter has been all about the old-time customs and ceremonies, and she's been all over. Other than the one little fight that they had, like, oh, he's so immature. She's been wanting this, dude. She's been wanting this to happen. Mon Mothma's just been turning a blind eye to it. This is all self-indulgent, her trying to do what she thinks a good mom would do, completely devoid of what her daughter actually wants.
See, I didn't get that impression because, I mean, I feel like this is like a, like an Indian marriage, an arranged marriage. Like my parents met this guy through work and I'm doing it because I have to. I'm not saying that she wasn't sort of into this guy, but I don't get the impression that Stecan was like her first choice. Not that it matters, because you don't, in Chandralan culture, you don't get a choice. Your parents tell you this is what's happening and it's...
She was on board with it.
Okay.
She was. You could see like in season 1, she started getting involved in the rituals and stuff that was going along with, you know, Skulden's.
She drank the MAGA Kool-Aid.
She got in. I think the situation is like Perrin and Mon have this really stilted relationship. They fight, and I think the daughter's kind of just more on the dad's side, you know. And dad's a little more fun, right? Yeah, I think dad's a little more fun. You know, Mon maybe plays the liberal or the anti, you know, fun person in this situation. So.
Well, let's talk about Skulden, because he basically reveals his wedding present to the couple, and it's a Shandi Merle, which is what, like an 8-foot-tall stone artifact, ancient artifact, one of only 12 in all of existence. It has a special place in Chandralan culture. It's, you know, super rare, super valuable.
Why do we care?
I mean, I don't think you're supposed to care. I think you're just supposed to realize that he's got a lot of money and pull, that he could get a famous artifact like that as a wedding present. I mean, it would be like, I don't even know what the equivalent would be for us, like getting one of the rocks from Stonehenge for
It has a bit more significance in the fact that it was like an important artifact that was stolen by the Rakatan invaders. So like the Rakatan Empire is like, you know, thousands of years ago, apparently, kind of like the Roman Empire, from what I understand it, like they conquered places, and so this is like a precious artifact that was stolen by the
returned back to Chandralan, right?
Yeah,
Skulden, he calls out Luthen, and he was like, "Hey, this is a long time coming. Luthen tracked down this rare artifact for me. I was able to buy it. And now it's, he says, you know, basically mm-hmm. the artifact has come home. It belongs on Chandralah. That's where it was created. Somebody took it a long time ago, but it's home, is what he says.
Cool. I mean, full marks for world building, but also zero marks.
Not that
for
important.
Relevance.
It was kind of a red herring because they talked a lot about it. There's secrecy about it, but yeah, it was, you know.
What I took away from it is, okay, this guy has a lot of money because he can buy a $10 billion statue for a wedding present and not care. We see Te Kolma is pretty visibly drunk at this wedding. He's been eyeballing Skulden. At one point, he talks to Mon Mothma, and he says, he could be very useful to me when they're looking at Skulden. If you remember, Mon Mothma and Luthen were really nervous last episode about Te Kolma being a loose cannon, not getting what he wanted. He's got a lot of skin in the game, and he hasn't got a lot back. So they're nervous. Mon is very nervous about him even thinking about talking to Skulden because Skulden's got a lot of power. So what we see a ceremonial first dance. Mon Mothma tears up a little bit. And Mon Mothma tracks down Luthen and they have a discussion. They're worried about Te Kolma basically flipping on them. And again, I forget who it is that say it, but they basically say, we'll find a number. We're going to buy this guy off. I don't care how much it costs. He's a loose cannon. We can't leave him, you know, to his own devices. He'll hook up with somebody else, and then we'll have a problem.
But Luthen says that there's no number good enough, right? Yeah, he says, like, it's always going to be a risk.
Yes. And so, yeah, Luthen basically slyly suggests that they have to kill Kolma because he's a liability. And I didn't write down the line, but she basically says something like, I can't even imagine that. And he was like, oh, that must be nice for you to not have to worry about that, you know, to not have to think about, I'm going to have to do it. I mean, he's basically saying, I'm going to have to get my hands dirty and kill this dude because he's going to come back to haunt us later. So we see right about then that sweet dance rave sphere disco ball comes out with
Nemos.
Wait, it's got a name?
That track. It's from Nemos.
Okay, I was going to ask you, because that music is sweet.
No, yeah, it's from the first season. It's the Miami Planet Beach.
Oh, really? Can you hook
rave
me up?
Music.
I was totally vibing to that music.
It's like
last
a new
night.
Remix that I don't know is out there yet, but it's Nemos, you know, with an exclamation point.
I was totally down for that. Dance Cube floats out. I mean, Dance Sphere.
Yeah, I don't know what
like
that
they
is.
Kind of all circle around it, and then like the wedding like really ramps up, like, and they start dancing in circles around it. Like, okay, this is what I was gonna say. You know who had fun at the Chandralon wedding? I mean, clearly it wasn't Mon Mothma, probably not laid up. You know who had fun? Everyone. Everyone fucking loved that wedding. They were going to town. That's what I'm saying. Right. You got a bunch of drunk rich people having a good time. Sign me up.
I didn't have fun at that wedding.
It's not my scene, but I can see it being fun for some people. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
There was like a little thing about a character named Erskine that Luthen was talking to. Because I was curious if this is going to come up later. I haven't seen any more. But like Luthen talked to this character called Erskine, and he was saying his background. Like randomly, he said he has connections to Chandralah, but his mom is Gorman from Naboo.
That guy. I didn't understand what that conversation was all about.
I didn't really either, but I think it's worth noting. And then Tay later says he'll call Erskine to set up the meeting. So he must have a connection to Tay, Kolma, to get... You know, their
I didn't
meeting
put that together.
Or their thing sorted out. I thought it was interesting. I don't know if he comes back, but like this is the end of the first year, and we're going to skip.
So again,
forward a
they're
year.
Doing three episode chunks. So this is the end of the first section, and then episode four was supposed to be a year later.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. We're going to skip forward a year.
So I want to talk briefly as the wedding scene comes to an end. Te Kolma basically is drunk and decides to leave, or he's like, I'm not having fun, whatever, he's got business to do, who knows.
No, totally understandable.
He he basically calls an Uber, and
doesn't he ask where his regular
he calls to get picked up.
Okay.
And then he, as he's walking out to the Uber, whatever it is, he was like, oh, hey, where's you know, where's Jeeves, my normal guy? She's like, oh, I don't know. I was just told to show up here.
Who is she?
Well, that's, I was going to, I don't know the lady's name, but it's Cinta. Belle's ex-girlfriend.
Cinta.
It's Cinta. Cinta. So Cinta, she's like, she plays it really well. She's like, oh, I don't know. I'm just a driver. I was just told to show up here. And then she gets in the car and like conveniently like Belle's walking, you know, by the venue, and she like glances over and sees Cinta, like gives her a little stink eye, like, what are you doing here kind of thing.
No, I don't think there's any question. I think they both work with Luthen, but their relationship is, you know, fractured, basically. Yeah.
Well, and the Do they both know the first rule of Work for Luthen Club is you don't talk about Work for Luthen Club. Mm,
yeah.
Do we know why Vel and Cinta broke up? Like, was that part of a thing that I just don't remember?
Did
it happen off screen?
It was more like Cinta's just way more into, you know, the work. She just doesn't feel the same way, I think. You know, there was some conversations.
The point is,
one,
is that they broke up and it was not amicable, right?
Yeah.
Well, and the point of that scene is that, look, Luthen's about to have Tacoma killed.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yes. So I guess that is the implication there. It's pretty black and white. But, like, there's loose ends there. If we just skip forward a year and skip past all of that, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm curious that's going to work. Because, I mean, clearly he's about to get killed.
We'll see.
We'll see next week.
Mm-hmm.
So Tacoma gets in the car with Cinta. They fly away, presumably to his death. And we get one final scene of the wedding, and the music is pumping. What was it again? Neimos. It was great. Everyone's dancing. Everyone's having a great time. Mon Mothma is looking exhausted. Like, I think there's a couple shots of her face. She's looking either exhausted or drunk or both. She's had a long day, and like, she's probably stressed out for dealing with the politics.
It seems like she's very upset, but also dancing her ass off, and it's pretty cool.
The very final scene we already talked about a little bit was Cassian saving the day, and on what planet was the farm planet?
Rina, whatever.
He shows up, saves the day. The only reason I bring it up again is because the episode opens with Cassian flying on the plane and closes with Cassian too. So it bookends the episode. So we see Cassian flying away, looking despondent, I should say, because pretty much everybody had died. He had to leave Brasso behind. He's got Bix and Will on the TIE. What was it?
The Proto-TIE.
Proto-TIE. Yeah. Proto-TIE. He's got them, and they're flying away. We don't know where they're going, but Cassian's not happy. I mean, he's got his crew back together a little bit, but he's not happy about
things.
Wait,
was B2 on the ship?
No, that's a good point. Did they leave? No, they had to. They must have left B2 with that farm. He's probably crying himself to sleep.
Yeah.
So you don't like B2 either?
I don't like him anymore.
I'm
used to love that robot. Now he's just...
Would you rather hang out with B2 for a weekend or go to a Chandrilan wedding?
I would rather make B2 go to the Chandrilan wedding.
AI right. can take, you know, the 4X multiplier.
So the only other note that I wrote down... Last week we were discussing what Perrin's job is, because he gave that wedding speech and I thought he spoke really well, which implied that he has some sort of public speaking background. So his name is Perrin Firtha. So interestingly, I don't know if that's Chandrilan culture or whatever, but they do not share a last name. We've got Mon Mothma and Perrin Firtha. And according to the internet, he is husband and consort of Senator Mon Mothma, who he married when they were teenagers. He's the father of Leeta Mothma. During the Imperial era, Firtha hosted events at the Chandrilan Embassy on Coruscant, including a dinner party for his friend, the governor of Hanna City, blah, blah, blah. So the point is that I think Perrin is just kind of like a rich socialite riding on Mon Mothma's tail. Or on her coattails. I don't think he's like a high up politician. I think he's just a rich dude.
Just kind of a trophy husband?
Maybe. Or I don't know. Maybe he came from money and their money comes from his family. But the point is that he doesn't have a high muckety muck job like I kind of expected him to. There's not a whole lot of backstory on him.
Hmm.
That's fair.
But they say Leeta Mothma, so the daughter.
Oh, that's a good point. It does say Leeta. So, yeah, I don't know how that works.
Huh. Mm. Maybe it's just.
And actually, why did they say Leeta Mothma and not Leeta, what's.
Yeah, whatever his
new last name.
All anyway. These mysteries will be answered in the next episode
of Chandrilan Weddings 4.0.
I hope we get another wedding. Yeah.
Dude, I would. I would totally watch another wedding season.
It's just when weddings. All, it's just what, every three episodes, just new weddings.
Maybe I can petition Tony Gilroy to make season three and it's just weddings. Like they're all dancing in a circle around the rave bot. Like the music was dope. They're all drunk. Like that looked like a good time. All right, episode over. We got to get wrapping up. I'll go first real quick. The episode was fun. I liked it. It was nothing amazing. Solid 7 out of 10.
Oh, that's low. I mean, I was going to give it 8.5 because I kind of wanted a little bit more for this sort of sub-finale of the three episodes, like especially the Mon Mothma stuff. It seems like if we skip past a year of what's going on there, I'm going to be pretty unsatisfied. But yeah, it was a pretty solid, definitely like on the low end of what I would rate like a big final episode for these arcs. So, yeah.
As far as the three-episode arc goes, I was slightly disappointed. Not slightly. Pretty disappointed with this one. I felt like we spent three episodes building up to this wedding, and it was pretty uninteresting. Nothing major really happened. There were no big revelations. There was the insinuation that Tae Kolma gets taken out, but that's about it.
That's the major point, and we don't see it. It's off screen.
It was all very subtle. And I'm not hating on Tony Gilroy.
Yeah.
But I'm hating on Tony Gilroy a little bit because it's like you built us up to nothing.
I'm with you. I think that was my problem with you had these three storylines, and they didn't particularly have amazing endings. Like you said, the wedding kind of tapers off. I guess the farm one's decent because Cassian saves them. I think
that was a great conclusion for that. For me,
the Daedra stuff was great because it was awkward, but it was awesome. It doesn't move the characters of the plot forward particularly.
I'll disagree with you on that. But yeah, I see what you're saying, Doug.
You want to give it a number?
The highest I would go is 7. So, yeah, I could do 7. It was all very well acted, very well written. It just kind of seemed to lack some purpose. And I know that we're still early in the season, so it's laying foundation and groundwork and just kind of showing us where everyone's at. But I wish it would have had a little bit more fireworks.
I would have given it a higher rating if this was episode 3 out of 10. But since we know this is the end of this chunk of the story, it didn't feel particularly satisfying to me.
Agree.
If it was just a regular middle episode, I would have been like, okay, cool. Yeah, it was good. It built up for whatever is coming. The Tae Kolma murder, the, you know, Cassian bombing around the universe. Like, clearly it was a bridge episode, but that's not... It was fun. I enjoyed it, just not amazing.
I wanted more. That's the thing. I'm going to be upset that we skip forward. Don't get it. But yeah, that's maybe he had to make some compromises in this new kind of formulation that he switched, you know, from 4 seasons down to 1. So yeah, anyway. Good episode. Logic.
Gate.
Doug, you have to participate.
What?
This is a group podcast. This is a humiliation ritual. We have to do this.
Every time. We have to humiliate ourselves. All right, Doug, you do it, and then we'll call it.
Logic 8 out.
There you go.